Brown Town Valley Associates, Inc., Nikki L. Marshall, Appellant Counsel, Joseph F. Silas Jr., Robert J. Light, Appellee Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Nikki Marshall.
Hold on. All right, we now have cleared the courtroom. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Nikki Marshall. I represent James Denton, the appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say three?
Three. While I'm certain that you're aware of the facts of this case, there are certain of the facts that are important when considering the lens through which the errors must be considered. I know that the court is familiar with the contract, the fact that it was first breached in 2005 when it was entered into for a reason that was unrelated to the contract terms, where Browntown was unable to reach an agreement with an adjacent property owner to expand a road or improve a road that that actually serviced the Denton property. Mr. Denton did not release Browntown from the contract at that time. They presented him with a release, which he failed to sign, and his own agent also presented him with a release, which he failed to sign. Browntown's agent admits that it returned the deposit for the contract to Browntown without checking on the release.
What does that have to do with whether or not your client was prepared to deliver a title free of clouds?
Your Honor,
this is really right to the chase.
Certainly.
There's a number of issues here, but the one that jumps out immediately is that the boundary settlement deed wasn't recorded until after the substitute trustee's deed. It may have been in existence, but it wasn't recorded. And so there's a lack of notice of the boundary settlement, and the cloud on the title remains. Now, it's four acres, 4.1 acres, whatever, but it's nonetheless a cloud on a waterfront lot on the Shenandoah River.
Your Honor, I do not believe that would indicate a cloud, a current cloud on the title. As the court indicated in its opinion letter, Mr. Denton was asking for specific performance in 2010. From the time of 2005 to 2010, it not only had that been recorded, but that property had been transferred. The bank sold it to some developers who actually recorded a plat prior in time to Mr. Denton's boundary agreement that actually reflected the same boundary that was in question, giving or conceding that 4.191 acres belonged to Mr. Denton.
Well, that may be so, but wouldn't the burden be on Mr. Denton to have his own suit to quiet title so that the purchaser would know there are no clouds on the title?
I do not believe, Your Honor, that is the state of the law here. I believe that when a plaintiff asks for specific performance of a contract, the contract is the law of the case. Browntown.
But the contract provides that he has to give a marketable title free of defect.
Yes, it does. And it also requires Browntown, prior to the conveyance of this property, to conduct a proper title examination.
Well, that might be so, but that doesn't have anything to do with the burden on Denton to deliver a marketable title.
I believe it does, Your Honor. Because I believe that the court has to look at this case through the contract terms, which is the law
of
the case.
Isn't that the problem? We're not dealing with law here. We're dealing with equity. A specific performance is a chancellor's remedy. It's not a common law remedy. And
it
it's fully discretionary. And if there's doubt, particularly if the burden of proof is on the proponent, as it normally is, and you're not sure exactly how the title is going to work out, it's discretionary for that extraordinary remedy not to be given, as the Chief is suggesting. So it's not so much the law of the case, the contractual language, it is the discretion of a prudent chancellor.
So, Your Honors, though, do you view this as that this could create so much of a problem in our real estate sales scheme, where these contracts provide that the purchaser has to investigate the title through the proper channels, through a title examiner who is licensed to examine title, who then refers it to a title insurance company, who then, you know, they give a Schedule B that has exceptions to the title and says, you know what, there's a problem with this title.
Counsel, if this was an action for breach of contract, your argument would be well taken. I'm going to be the third to raise the exact same issue. You are seeking specific performance. It is an equitable remedy. You must show that title was marketable in order to meet your burden of persuasion.
So if we have to prove marketable title just to the point that it is rebutted by the defendant, who is then going to say, no, it is not good title, does the court not consider then that Mr. Denton had been in uninterrupted possession of his property for the 22 years he had had it prior to trial and 75 years prior to that?
The claim of adverse possession is not marketable title.
Your Honor, neither Mr. Denton nor his predecessor in title claimed through adverse possession. They claimed through a fee simple deed that they received. Their position on this is that a surveyor went out there, and because we have newer surveying equipment available to us, that there was a difference in the amount of acreage that was claimed. And many, many times in Virginia, when you have old farms that are cut up over and over again, you have problems with these old surveys where they're done with chains.
Which affects the marketability of the title in the 21st century.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. But I do not.
We would go right back to the title is not marketable.
Right.
Now, let me ask this question. With regard to the deed that you attempted to keep out of evidence, you argued that you argued five different reasons why it should be kept out, but none of which were specifically identified as hearsay. But then you later indicated in your reply brief that was subsumed within your incomplete chain of title objection. There is no transcript from your argument on the motion in limine that is in the joint appendix or in the record. Do you recall whether a court reporter was present for that motion in limine, and whether there's perhaps a transcript that's missing, or was there just simply no transcript?
There is no transcript, Your Honor. It was done by a phone conference.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Counsel.
So getting back to the issue of the motion in limine that you were just speaking of, you cannot just pull a cherry pick a deed out of an adjacent landowner's title and indicate that is a current defect. I mean, the plat that was recorded with the boundary agreement was the same plat that was recorded prior in time to Mr. Denton's deed that said that a boundary agreement would be necessary. The title insurer did not require that Mr. Denton file a quiet title action in order to ensure that title. And
the title insurer took exception to the...
Exactly, and Mr.
Well,
Denton's
then,
position...
So the title insurer did not insure the very issue that we're talking about. The title insurer insured everything else with regard to the title except that.
And Mr. Denton's position on that is that Wayside was, in fact, the owner at the time that the boundary agreement was entered into, and he was in a position to make that agreement. And even though it was not recorded prior in time to the substitute trustee's deed, that it did meet the requirements from the title insurer.
Does the record reflect why it wasn't recorded?
Mr. Denton testified at trial that the attorney at the time did not, it was lost on his desk or something, and he did not, he just didn't record it. And then sometime later, Mr. Denton inquired about the recordation of the deed, and it was found and then recorded.
That's unfortunate.
So the attorney did not do anything further. He didn't contact the title insurer, to our knowledge, and it was recorded at that time with no reference given to where the Wayside property was at that time. You know, all we know is that, you know, it would seem that it is much ado about nothing, because all of the subsequent transfers of this property have clearly held that line. And so Mr. Denton is going to be required to file a quiet title action when the owner has no objection. Who is it exactly that we are quieting title against when the adjacent owner adopted that line even before the boundary agreement was entered, was put to record, and has continued along through four conveyances and has not questioned that title? And so we must then go back and relive that entire thing over again for what purpose?
To have marketable title, which is a term that's generally understood and recognized and respected within the real estate profession.
And marketable title is defined in both the
insurable at regular rates.
Right. For Cogito.
Without exception.
Right. But it's defined in Cogito v. Dart and in Jackson v. Ligon as, you know, having no liens or encumbrances and not being having no, you know, doubt in the title. But in both of those instances, the purchaser submitted that to a title examination, and then it was then submitted to a title insurance company, who then opined that the title was not good, and then the seller was given an opportunity then to cure that defect according to the terms of their contract. So our position, Your Honor, is that it is a breach of contract case in sorts, because we're asking the court to specifically perform that contract wherein Browntown was required to conduct a title examination at the onset of this contract, which of course we know they did not do, because my client's position is that they never intended to go through with the contract once they realized that their road was not going to work out for them, because they just submitted a release that never got signed, returned the deposit to Browntown, and never contacted Mr. Denton any further. I mean, the record is clear that these facts are not
disputed. So is your position that the contract, going to the contract language, it says, right, that Denton had to deliver good and marketable title insurable by a licensed title company with no additional risk premium?
Yes, Your Honor. And in the jurisdictional addendum at paragraph 7, it says that Browntown is to, within 10 days of execution of the contract, is to contact the closing agent and order a title on the property. It also says then that title is supposed to be presented, you know, prior to closing, so that Mr. Denton can make whatever is, you know, action that is necessary to clear that title so that Browntown could get insurance that would be at no additional risk premium. It's really a which came first, the chicken or the egg argument here, where this is standard procedure.
You've got 2 minutes, and you can use your time any way you want. I just want to tell you that you're well below the three you wanted.
Okay, Your Honor. Well, I will say, so I will use another 40 seconds of my rebuttal time, in that I believe that the court could look and extend the law of Piers v. Barnett here, where I believe that in the Piers case, we had a purchaser who, in that case, was in possession of the property, but then who didn't make their installment payments. When the seller came back and said, "Trustee, I want you to sell this property," the purchasers came back and said, "Oh, wait a minute, we're going to contest the title in this matter." And what the court said in Piers is, you know what, the passage of time has cured any defect to which you are now claiming. You've been in possession of the property. I mean, that in that case, it was like 20 years or something of litigation. But the court would have none of it. And
may
just
I
said
interrupt
that,
and return you, before you lose all of your time, to Justice Mims' question? Supposing that you have a good breach of contract case, you have a benefit of the bargain. I sold it at X dollars. It's actually fair market value X minus 10,000. So you'd be entitled to 10,000. But that scenario and that cause of action is not an equitable claim for specific performance. And it seems to me the struggle we're having in our dialogue with you is that there is an additional burden in equity. And the additional burden is at the time the chancellor issues the order, there's got to be marketable title, notwithstanding how it got to be unmarketable.
And I would say, Your Honor, that we met that initial burden. Thank you. And I'll reserve 16 seconds for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, my name is Robert Light. I'm attorney for Appalee Browntown Valley Associates. In this case, Your Honor, Mr. Denton sought only specific performance, which this Court has recognized as an extraordinary equitable remedy, and it's difficult to obtain. Among other elements, he took the burden upon himself of proving that at minimum he had a prima facie claim of marketable title to the disputed 4.191 acres. The trial court found in a motion, in granting the motion to strike, he failed to meet his burden of proof. Denton's appeal of the motion to strike essentially fails for three reasons. Reason number one, and counsel has been discussing this, is Denton argues that if you give probative value to the wayside foreclosure deed, that you're ignoring the weight of subsequent land of the subsequent land record showing that the boundary was adopted by subsequent purchasers. And in fact, she repeated here that about the subsequent transfers. The problem is there are no such records in evidence. In the reply brief, first of all, the argument is first raised in the brief at pages 25 and 26. Then in the reply brief, she points to post-trial land records which were not proffered at the trial, but were proffered instead as part of the post-trial motion for reconsideration. In denying that motion, the trial court rightly refused to consider any post-trial land records which were not introduced or admitted into evidence in the original February 19th, 20th, 2015 trial. I would note to this court that the trial court's ruling on this point is not a basis for appeal before you. Therefore, there is no evidence of record supporting.
Why isn't it a basis for appeal?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't it a basis for appeal? But the trial court actually did consider the reconsideration motion.
It did consider the reconsideration motion,
and
but
the Brandon v. Cox, that then the arguments that are made within that motion are subject to appeal if properly noted by an assignment of error, because the court actually did consider the reconsideration.
To my knowledge, Mr. Denton has not assigned error to the trial court saying, I will not consider these post-trial land records because they were discoverable.
Your argument simply is there's no assignment of error.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Therefore, for our purposes, those records are out. We can't look at them.
Correct.
And that's one reason the appeal must fail.
One among many, Your Honor. Further, Your Honor, as for Mr. Denton's argument that the trial court abused its discretion and admitted the wayside foreclosure deed into evidence, contrary to the hearsay rule, as Your Honor's questions have indicated, Mr. Denton did not raise a substantive hearsay objection to the foreclosure deed at the trial court level. The Jackson versus Chesapeake case indicates that while you may you don't have to cite chapter and verse, you cannot change your basis for objection from the trial court versus the appellate court. As a matter of fact, I think in the brief we cited to the transcript indicate some indication from argument on the foreclosure deed when we were discussing the relevance of it. It seemed that Mr. Denton's arguments all basically go to relevance, not to hearsay. The second reason why, and at any rate, let me also add before I move on, The court properly admitted those cases in any those land records at any rate under section 801-389 of the code, which allows the court to admit into evidence properly authenticated land records, and also says that those land records and the facts stated therein are prima facie evidence.
Well, it appeared to me as well that the boundary settlement deed was being introduced to show the date of it. That was the real issue, that it hadn't, it was being filed or put to record after the substitute trustee's deed. That was the reason for it, wasn't it?
Yes. So, but it was also to show, well, it also recited the fact that Wayside's property was subject to a deed of trust lien, that deed of trust lien was foreclosed upon, and it was, and the property was transferred for, as part of that foreclosure sale 8 months before the foreclosure deed. The second reason that the motion that the appeal of the motion to strike fails, there's been again, and this has been emphasized by today in front of you, is Denton's argument that Browntown should not have been able to introduce the foreclosure deed without benefit of a title examiner or evidence of title examination. What we would point out, Your Honor, is that Mr. Denton conveniently ignores his own trial conduct. In attempting to make his prima facie case for a marketable title, he likewise introduced certain selected land records into evidence at trial without a without the benefit of a title examination or testimony from a title examiner. Indeed, it's worth noting that Mr. Denton withdrew his title expert witness designation approximately 2 weeks before trial. Were this court to adopt the rule being urged by Mr. Denton, namely, you can't put in land records without a title examination or a expert testimony from a title examiner, again, because Mr. Denton has the burden of proof on marketable title, it would seem that even under his own theory, he would likewise fail because due to his own trial conduct. In any event, the Cogito case only requires that the trial court review the record before as it finds it. The third reason why the motion to the appeal of the motion strike fails is Denton's contractual argument. He makes basically two arguments. Number one, Browntown was obligated by the sales contract to order title examination, and two, Browntown waived objections to marketable title by not obtaining the title report in 2005. Neither argument is supported by the plain language of the sales contract as admitted. In paragraph 7 of the jurisdictional addendum, the contrary to what was stated today, the express obligation to order a title exam is on the settlement agent, not on Browntown itself. In fact, paragraph 19 of the initial contract is silent on whose party it was. Now, the settlement agent is also designated as the representative to the contract and not to any particular party. So even if the therefore the plain language of the contract itself doesn't say Browntown must order title. It says Browntown must submit the contract to the settlement agent, which there was testimony from Ms. Burracker that she did so, and the settlement agent is to order title. However, even if the obligation was Browntown's,
I don't know that that's the foundation you want to base your argument on. I mean, the purchaser selects the settlement agent.
That is correct. You did hear.
The seller simply shows up with a deed and affidavit.
Well, I think, and that goes on to the following point, is even if the court is not persuaded by that argument.
This member of the court is not. So.
No. Even taking that, nowhere does the express contract language provide for waiver of title objections if a title report is not ordered or produced. To say otherwise would be in effect this court adding language to a clear and unambiguous contract, which would go contrary to the Ames decision. In any event, Your Honor, paragraph 19 of the contract gave Mr. Denton his relief in the event of a failure to order title, or the failure of someone to order a title exam, which was terminate the contract and everybody goes home. Instead, what he chose to do was take upon himself the option of and the burden of attempting to file suit for specific performance, knowing full well that there was, and knew indeed from the beginning of the suit, that there was an issue regarding marketable title.
And there was, I mean, this dragged on for years. I mean, there was ample time for a quiet title.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
To resolve the question and put him in the position.
Correct. The initial complaint was filed approximately 3 days before the statute of limitations, the 5-year statute of limitations would have run. And in addition, there was a 2.5-year gap, even once litigation began, where nothing occurred. So, yes, there was plenty of time to have done a quiet title action. Now, as to the argument to extend Pierce v. Barnett to excuse the failure to raise quiet title, that argument in any form was not raised before the trial court. The Appalachian Voices decision, Rule 525, were clear that issues raised for the first time before the appellate court cannot be considered.
I didn't sense a lot of appetite for that proposition anyway.
But I think it is, but to continue on, assume this court wishes to consider it. Pierce is distinguishable. It's not a specific performance case. It was a case regarding, if I remember correctly, it's a note collection. It was an older way of collecting on a note, which modern practice no longer does. And the two biggest issues there, or at least the one in my mind, which is the chief distinguishing factor, is the fact that unlike specific performance case, in that case, the defendant actually had a general warranty deed and had had possession of the property for several years, and was now challenging title in order to exonerate themselves, having to pay the rest of the purchase money notes. That is clearly distinguishable from this case. Finally, extending the case would have the effect of overruling a line of cases, including the Madmuth decision, which was decided a century later, that said that part of marketable title, you can't convey title if there is a risk of litigation to the party who you're trying to force to take title from you. Obviously, the court in that case considered that, well, maybe if you could have a success, if they could show you would have a successful claim, and the court ultimately said no. The mere fact you have a possibility of a lawsuit doesn't satisfy the burden of marketable title. Regarding attorney's fees, we believe that the majority of these assertions were based on inaccuracies about the record. Contrary to what Mr. Denton asserted, the trial court did consider the attendant circumstances factor in deciding to reduce the attorney fee award in compliance with the Richlands case. Further, the argument that that Browntown had not discounted out the fees relating to a third-party complaint. You had testimony. You had the face of the affidavit itself, showing exactly how much was deducted from that. In addition, you had John Foote, who was the expert witness for Browntown, indicating that at least as to the first affidavit, he had done his own spreadsheet to make sure check the math and concluded that the math was accurate. The only substantive issue regarding attorney's fees concerns the waiver of an affirmative defense on the first breach doctrine. This court's decision in the Monahan versus Obici Medical Management Services mandated that because the first breach doctrine is an affirmative defense and a complete defense to the claim for attorney's fees, they had to raise it at the beginning or waive it entirely. Denton claims that there was no prejudice despite his failure to raise this argument for over 4 years. The court in Obici only allowed an exception where an issue only arose in the context of litigation as it went forward. In this case, the claim for attorney's fees and any claim for first breach defense was obvious at the beginning of the case and therefore should have been raised if Mr. Denton desired to raise that as a defense to paying attorney's fees under the fee-shifting provisions of the contract. Finally, Your Honors, I would note that In the request, in the remedy requested, Mr. Denton is asking that basically you order the trial court to give him specific performance and determine a reasonable amount of attorney's fees to him. We believe that that request, even if this court were to find that there was merit to his appeal, is premature. We would remind the court that this comes on a motion to strike. The trial court, under the Claycomb v. Dietewick decision, is not sitting as a trier of fact in that situation. Therefore, the most this court can do, if you were to grant the appeal, would be to simply say, Mr. Denton has met his prima facie case on marketable title, and instruct the trial court to weigh the evidence and sit as a trier of fact in order to determine who actually is victorious in the case. Because the substantive victor of the case has not yet been determined, a claim for attorney's fees is premature. Therefore, for all these reasons, we would ask this court to respectfully deny the appeal and affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Ms. Marshall?
Is this my time? 16 seconds? Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I would just say that the contract did mandate then to conduct a title examination prior to Mr. Denton having to convey marketable title. Browntown instructed the agent to hold off on doing such an examination. Clearly says that the contract says that he did have time to cure any defect. And the Cogito case clearly said that the record is clear. The seller's title was traced to or through an old chancery suit, and the perceived defect was submitted to a title insurance company. And I would submit that that was a necessary part of a specific performance action on this particular contract. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 5 minutes after 11.
All rise.